Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to Ottawa, Canada's capital, where there was a violent shootout inside the Parliament with an assailant who had shot and killed a Canadian soldier guarding the National War Memorial, then entered the Parliament building with guns blazing. David Harris, a former director of strategic plans at the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, joins us to discuss the apparent cause and effect of the attacks on Canadian soldiers, which followed the Canadian Parliament's vote to join the Anti-Islamic State Alliance. Then we'll go to Sydney, Australia, to speak with Frank Stilwell, Professor Emeritus in the Department of Political Economy at the University of Sydney, about the passing of the popular and progressive former Australian Prime Minister Gough Whitlam, who was removed from power in a constitutional coup in 1975 that Whitlam suggested the CIA had a hand in encouraging, a charge the US government has repeatedly denied. We will discuss the sweeping foreign policy changes Whitlam made, recognizing China, Cuba, and Hanoi, getting out of the Vietnam War and publicly criticizing Nixon's Christmas bombing of Hanoi, while establishing universal health care, banning racial discrimination, making education free for all Australians, lowering the voting age, and abolishing military conscription. Then finally, following the conviction of four former Blackwater security guards for shooting more than 30 unarmed Iraqi civilians in 2007, we will speak with Robert Young Pelton, the author of License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror. He is currently suing the founder of Blackwater, Eric Prince, who is now working for the Chinese government with a new mercenary company, Frontier Services Group. We will look into the irony of the United States government putting military contractors on trial for carrying out orders issued by the U.S. government. And joining us now is David Harris, who is a former director of strategic plans at the Canadian Security Intelligence Service from 1988 to 1990. He has 30 years' experience in national security and intelligence affairs and has testified at U.S. congressional subcommittees and Canadian parliamentary committee hearings and is currently the director of the International Intelligence Program of Insignis Strategic Research, Inc., as well as on the advisory board of the Council for Muslims Facing Tomorrow, a Canadian Muslim organization dedicated to advancing freedom, social cohesion, and challenging radicalism. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Harris.
Thank you very much indeed, Ian.
And the it's hard not to notice a coincidence between the Canadian Parliament voting to join the anti-ISIS coalition and these attacks. One, a car attacked a car with two Canadian soldiers, one of whom died and the other was grievously wounded. And, of course, the shootout in the Canadian Parliament, which was preceded by the murder of a Canadian soldier at the War Memorial. Is there a link there?
Well, of course, we cannot know, but it's certainly been credibly asserted that the first assault just a day or so ago involving a vehicular homicide in which, as you mentioned, a Canadian soldier was killed, another injured, and ultimately the perpetrator himself shot to death by police, didn't have at least the kind of flavor one would anticipate in a radical Islamist assault. This individual had quite a record, it appears, of jihadi-type sympathy. And now, of course, we're left to try to determine what we're dealing with in the current situation. There have not been specifics at this point, but it would hardly be irresponsible to put the question in a pretty pointed way.
Well, this person that you're referring to, Martin Arullo Couture, is reportedly converted to Islam about a year ago, and police interviewed him last July and confiscated his passport. But they lacked enough; didn't have enough evidence to keep him in custody. And he was arrested. When he was arrested, he was about to go to Turkey to join the Islamic State. So it's pretty clear where his allegiances lie. What do we know about the suspect in the attack on the Parliament and the War Memorial, Michael Zahaf Bibo?
Well, as far as the assault itself was concerned, it began around 10 o'clock Eastern Standard Time here in Canada's capital, Ottawa, in the very center and heart of the downtown area at the War Memorial, which is an iconic kind of memorial that's existed here for a great many years. And there it appears that an individual who was with the Canadian military on formal guard duty was shot to death by the assailant. The assailant then, according to some reports, and things are still being settled, may have hijacked a vehicle and made his way several hundred meters to the Parliamentary Hill precincts, which is really a kitty corner. Then he made his way ultimately up to the center block of our Parliament Hill, an impressive neo-Gothic structure, and gained access in ways that aren't clear to the center of that area, I mean the very heart of the center block. And at that time, the caucuses of the main political parties, in other words, the members of the MPs, the members of Parliament, were meeting in their various respective political rooms for discussion. Indeed, where the Conservative Party is concerned, the Prime Minister of Canada, who leads, as you know, a Conservative government, was meeting with his caucus. And one of the subjects, it's imagined, that would have had to have come up for discussion would have been the redoubling of counterterrorism efforts, with specific reference to new legislation that the government is expected to be coming forward with on a counterterrorism basis. So this is a situation that is intriguing on a number of levels, not least from an intelligence perspective, where one would be interested in knowing what the state of knowledge in specific tactical terms of the assailant might have been.
And apparently it was the bravery of the Sergeant-at-Arms, Kevin Vickers, that prevented the deaths of MPs.
Yes, yes, that seems to be the understanding of things. And he is an individual who was formerly an officer of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police and appeared to have had considerable sharpshooter credentials well before this. So his talents clearly were mustered in favor of security.
So just can you give us a general broad picture of the security situation vis-a-vis the idea that there may be sleeper cells? I know we spoke years ago about that possibility. You obviously work in terms of trying to bring about social reconciliation with the organization that you're on the board of, the Council for Muslims Facing Tomorrow, which is dedicated to advancing freedom, social cohesion, and challenging radicalism. And it's always been pretty clear to me.
I apologize. It sounded a bit difficult. I'm in the downtown area in the open, and as I understand it, yes, you've asked about some of the considerations that at least moderate Muslims have. I'm a non-Muslim member of the advisory board, and I'm not somebody who speaks for the organization Muslims Facing Tomorrow, but they represent an impressive and one might even say heroic strain of Muslims in Canada who've been dedicated to moderation, often in the teeth of opposition from some of the established, ostensible Muslim Canadian representative groups, some of which would seem to have ties to a Muslim Brotherhood kind of ideology. Indeed, we had something of a scandal emerge very recently in the form of a so-called counter-radicalization handbook that was, it appeared, released under the auspices of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, which has been involved in what is sometimes referred to as outreach, and an organization called the National Council of Canadian Muslims, as well as another Islamic organization. One of the difficulties is that the National Council of Canadian Muslims, the NCCM, is the renamed Canadian Council on American Islamic Relations, CARECAN. And that is the Canadian chapter of a Saudi-funded, Washington, D.C.-based organization called CARE, which was designated an unindicted co-conspirator in the Holy Land Foundation trial, an extremely successful U.S. prosecution. So all of this raises some questions about the extent of due diligence undertaken by the RCMP. And what has shaken some people, especially moderate Muslims, is that in this book, aside from calling for a certain kind of censorship on conversation about the subject of Islamic radicalism by banning, as it were, words like jihadist and Islamist, even though, of course, one or two of those words were innovated precisely to avoid their being confused with regular Islam, so to say. We found, in addition to all of that, that on page 13, I think it was, of the handbook, they recommended certain Islamic scholars whom the handbook advertised as being reliable in a counterterrorism context. To the regret of many, they included at least a handful of individuals who are noted fairly routinely as being among the most radical of North American Islamic scholars. Ingrid Mattson, of course, Ziad Shakir, Siraj Wahaj, who is often described as having been a designated unindicted co-conspirator in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. And here's where it gets very relevant to Americans. Once this publication was issued, the U.S. State Department, to the astonishment of many, actually tweeted the document, apparently conferring some degree of legitimacy on it internationally, and perhaps allowing some of its less desirable authors to claim to be the authors of a state-of-the-art counter-radicalization effort. This is a very curious world in which we live.
So how many Canadians have joined the Islamic State, do you know?
We don't know specifically, but there has been considerable testimony by experts in the field. We have been told that there may be 130 people who've gone abroad to join various foreign terrorist-type groups, and that perhaps 80 have returned, so that these are under surveillance, but the actual numbers could be somewhat more significant and worrying.
And is there any linkage with the current suspect who was shot in the shootout in the parliament, Michael Zahaf Pibo?
I'm sorry, but I must break now. I'm coming up to a scheduled interview.
Well, I thank you for the time that you could spare with us here today, and I thank you for joining us, David Harris.
Oh, pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with David Harris, who is a former director of strategic plans at the Canadian Security Intelligence Service from 1988 to 1990. He has 30 years' experience in national security and intelligence affairs, and he testified at the U.S. Congressional Subcommittees and Canadian Parliamentary Committee hearings, and is currently the director of the International Intelligence Program of Insignis Strategic Research, Inc., as well as on the advisory board of the Council for Muslims Facing Tomorrow, a Canadian Muslim organization dedicated to advancing freedom, social cohesion, and challenging radicalism. And of course, he is very much in demand today. That is why he cut off the interview to do a television broadcast. We're going to take a brief station break and be back and go to Sydney, Australia, to talk about the passing of former Prime Minister of Australia, Gough Whitlam. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Sydney, Australia, is Frank Stilwell, who is a Professor Emeritus in the Department of Political Economy at the University of Sydney, who is a well-known critic of conventional economics and an advocate for alternative economic strategies which prioritize social justice and economic sustainability. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frank Stilwell.
My pleasure, Ian.
And in the introduction that you didn't hear to the program, Frank, I mentioned the passing of former Australian Prime Minister Gough Whitlam, and the fact that he was removed from power in a constitutional coup in 1975, that Whitlam suggested the CIA had a hand in encouraging, a charge the US government has repeatedly denied. And I wanted to discuss, obviously for the benefit of the American audience who may not know about this former Prime Minister, the sweeping foreign policy changes that Whitlam made, recognizing China, Cuba, and Hanoi, getting out of the Vietnam War, publicly criticizing Nixon's Christmas bombing of Hanoi, while establishing universal health care, banning racial discrimination, making education free for all Australians, lowering the voting age, and abolishing military conscription. So given that description, that's in the American context, that's very, very progressive. I mean, you'd have to go back to FDR and the early years of LBJ, I think, to... Well, let me ask you, how would you compare Whitlam in terms of his progressive politics and the changes he made in Australia to, say, the American political history?
It was certainly a very dramatic period in Australia. We're talking here the early to mid-70s. There'd been 23 years of a conservative government. Indeed, one might say in general, Australia seemed a pretty complacent place at that time. And then suddenly there was this new government elected, led by Gough Whitlam, that was doing a lot of things. It was what Whitlam called the program, and it was a very extensive program of economic reform, social reform, of foreign affairs changes of the sort that you've mentioned. Hard to think of anything comparable in the United States in recent years. To give a little example, Whitlam pushed through a National Health Service. I mean, it made the struggles over Obamacare seem like a vicarage tea party. These were dramatic changes that were pushed through very quickly. Comparable, yes, with, I think, the FDR program during the 1930s in the United States, but of course with nothing like the same duration. Whitlam was come and gone within 3 years. Comparable perhaps to Johnson's Great Society program, yes, but whereas Johnson was promulgating the Vietnam War, of course, and that came to dominate other aspects of his program. Here was Whitlam saying, let's get out of Vietnam so we can concentrate on getting our own house in order.
So the fact that he was so progressive, both domestically and in terms of foreign policy, recognizing China, Cuba, and Hanoi, and particularly publicly criticizing Nixon's Christmas bombing of Hanoi, which both Kissinger and as mentioned, infuriated President Nixon. Is there anything to the persistent rumors, which, of course, Whitlam himself suggested the CIA had a hand in encouraging this constitutional coup that took place that removed him from office after only 3 years? And he was, of course, elected with a very popular mandate. So it's a kind of perennial story, and it's never been a lot of clarity on it. How do you come down on it?
Yeah. Still being discussed. There were publications at the time by left journalists such as Dennis Freeney from the Tribune newspaper, and subsequently, and rather more prominently, by John Pilger, a well-known Australian journalist, alleging strong CIA links. Whitlam himself, as you noted, did allude on more than one occasion to the problem of challenging U.S. influence. I think two major thrusts to the story. One is about spying. There was a particular U.S. facility in Central Australia, still there, known as Pine Gap, and it's been described as a giant vacuum cleaner which allows the U.S. to spy on everyone. And I don't think the Australians at the time knew exactly what was going on, but Whitlam seemed rather determined to put the focus on this because he surmised that this made Australia vulnerable to attack by Russia during that period of the Cold War because it made us so closely an arm of the U.S. international spy network. So there was, I think, a real material basis for thinking that U.S. interests would be rather resistant to anything that threatened the future of their spying network and those bases in Australia. And, of course, they did appoint Marshall Breen as the ambassador to the United States in 1974, and Green had been had something of a reputation as a coup master. I think he'd been in Indonesia in 1965 when the coup against President Sukarno occurred, leading to about a million people dying. So no doubt he was a hard man on the scene representing U.S. interests. And there were some whistleblowers who were pointing out that this was U.S. gathering information that was not necessarily to the interests of the United States. So it is a complicated story, but secondly, it was all set against the backdrop of a deteriorating economic situation, falling U.S. investment in Australia as they were worried about where this reforming government might take it, and some would say a capital strike that helped to destabilize the economic circumstances.
Again, Again, I'm speaking with Frank Stilwell, who is in Sydney, Australia. He's a professor emeritus in the Department of Political Economy at the University of Sydney and is a well-known critic of conventional economics and an advocate for alternative economic strategies which prioritize social justice and economic sustainability. And we're talking about the death of former Australian Prime Minister Gough Whitlam, who was removed from power in a constitutional coup in 1975. And the constitutional coup itself took place where the Governor-General, who's the Queen's representative, essentially sacked him, even though he was in power and there was a no-confidence vote that was about to be brought about. But there were all kinds of chicanery with the Speaker locked out. And it does, I mean, it's pretty extraordinary what happened. And even the royal family, who are represented by the attorney, by the Governor General, were embarrassed by the actions of the Attorney General, who ironically was appointed by Prime Minister Gough Whitlam. I'm trying to give a description of the coup itself to an American audience. Is there anything you can add to that?
Yeah, again, if one's thinking of U.S. parallels, I mean, Australians still recall where they were on November the 11th, 1975, when this coup occurred, rather as people might recall where they were and what they were doing when they heard of the shooting of President Kennedy. Now, I'm not saying it was quite as dramatic as that, but by Australian standards, this was a remarkable phenomenon. I mean, that connection with the UK history, personified in the role of this Governor General, generally thought of as a sort of a rather ceremonial function. But here was this unelected person flexing his muscles and sacking the Prime Minister. Some would say the Prime Minister should have just told him to go to hell, you know, and not to accept the sacking. But Whitlam, being of a legal background, I think was actually rather reluctant to precipitate that kind of potentially revolutionary social and political situation. So they accepted the sacking. And said, "Oh well, let's just hope we win the forthcoming election that the Governor General had insisted be called." But they got wiped out of the forthcoming election because I think people were rather sick of the instability, and they voted for the alternative, more conservative government, not because Whitlam's major program of social reforms had been unpopular, but because it had been associated with so much political instability, and people felt deeply uncomfortable about that, as well as, of course, about the deteriorating economic situation that was happening around the world in most capitalist nations at that time.
So just to touch on the U.S. facility at Pine Gap that you mentioned, it was key to the concerns that the U.S. had. It's still I believe, is still the biggest CIA station outside of the United States. It's right in the center of Australia near Alice Springs, and it's where all the geosynchronous satellites that are watching the Middle East and China and the former Soviet Union download their information, and then it's bounced across to the United States. So to that extent, Australia bought itself a front row seat in a nuclear war with the Soviet Union, or indeed with the current Russia, because it is such a vital base. Now, in the case of the Falcon and the Snowman, these two young men out here in California who back in the 70s, I think, or late 70s, were caught spying for Russia. They worked at a secret facility that downloaded all the information from Pine Gap here in TRW here in Los Angeles, Christopher Boyce in particular. And he, in his trial, in his defense, he was allowed to enter into evidence as evidence of his motives for why he spied for Russia was that his deep sense of outrage at what the traffic that he was reading, saying that the CIA were conducting a coup against an elected Australian prime minister, who, of course, Australia being an ally of the United States. Now, Boyce is not the most credible person, clearly, and that was in his defense. So what do you make of that? And did that ever have any traction in Australia?
Well, it was big news at the time when his revelations became public. He talked about, if I recall, the deception and betrayal of an ally. Becoming a whistleblower is always a tough call. People are going to try and discredit you. But Boyce did come out very publicly. He revealed that the Governor-General of Australia, Sir John Kerr, was known within the business as Our Man Kerr, implying that he was answerable more to the CIA than to the Australian people. So these were strong allegations. But I have to say that by this time, the Whitlam government was discredited, I think, in the eyes of many Australian people for its inability to maintain and implement its full program. So even though it looked like there was some nasty business going on behind the scenes, I think that it was the role of the media, and in particular Rupert Murdoch's media, that represented the Australian government to the Australian people in a way that was not very laudable. So if we're talking about villains in the story, I would rate the Murdoch media up there more highly than the role of the CIA.
And, of course, the Murdoch media dominate Australian media and information. I think they own, 60% of all media in Australia, or even more than that?
Yeah, Murdoch himself, of course, was originally Australian before he became a U.S. citizen in order to further his interests in America. His domination of the print media, absolutely overwhelming, and he really used that. Well, initially, to facilitate Whitlam coming to power, he was a Whitlam supporter in 72, but by 74, he was absolutely on a mission to overthrow the government.
Well, yeah, but that's how he works. He does the same in England. You know, he's for Tony Blair, and then he doesn't like Gordon Brown and so on. He's just a kingmaker. And he actually tried to enlist General Petraeus to run against Barack Obama, and that's why they gave Petraeus the job at the CIA, to get him off the street. Let's talk a little bit about Australia as a social democracy. I was just there a few days ago, as a matter of fact, and it's an extraordinarily wealthy country. That the average people in Australia, the working people and middle-class people, have an incredibly high standard of living, a lot of disposable income, the place is thriving. They escaped the 2008 crash because of good economic stewardship under the former Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd, but the Labor Party fought amongst themselves in a ridiculous and shameful way, and they allowed this incredible reactionary to come in, who's the Conservative Prime Minister now, Tony Abbott, who is to my mind, since I live here in the United States, a complete throwback to George W. Bush. It's like we've already had Bush, the most discredited president in American history, and now you've got this global warming denying character who seems to be completely in the pocket of the mining lobby, basically giving away the store in a country that is the most affected by global warming. That's according to a recent report by NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. So what happened?
Well, I'm going to have to try and stop foaming at the mouth myself in here, because I knew the new Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, when he was a student at Sydney University, where I taught most of my career. And he was never an admirable figure, or a rather bullying student politician. And essentially, he hasn't changed. This is not just the most right-wing Australian politician in the Prime Minister's office that anyone can recall. It's probably the most opportunistic and unprincipled leader. The position on climate change, the complete reversal of all the promises made before the election, a budget that is directly targeted at the interests of the lower-income people but favouring upper-income groups. It's a terrible program, almost exactly the mirror opposite of the Whitlam era that we were talking about earlier. In other words, here's a younger prime minister on a mission to turn Australia back to the sort of conditions that existed before the Whitlam reforms laid the basis for a more progressive Australia.
But we've seen that here in the United States. In you know, arguably the U.S. had a sort of social democracy, not as advanced as Australia's and certainly as the Scandinavians. But it from say 1944 to 1977, there was a sort of social democracy, and Reagan then rolled it back to the point now where the country's arguably an oligarchy, and the disparity in wealth is so huge. What I find extraordinary is that why would the Australians, who have such a successful social democracy, and there was just a recent report, I think, from the UN saying that Australia is the number one country in the world for gross domestic happiness, in the sense that the average person has the best standard of living in the world. So why would they invite a rollback of the very thing that makes them a successful country?
It's a puzzling enigma for someone like myself, who's spent so much of his time trying to advocate for more progressive social democratic reforms. But I think you have to lay some of the blame on the Labor Party itself, that its periods of office under Whitlam and more recently under the leaders Kevin Rudd and Julia Gillard have been rather tumultuous ones. Social reforms have been implemented, but a lot of internal party conflict, factionalism, the occasional scandals have played into the hands of a conservative media who want to represent these governments as trying to do too much too quickly. You referred earlier to the global financial crisis. Now, I mean, it was indeed remarkable that the Australian Labor Party Prime Minister at the time implemented such a successful policy to prevent that crisis impacting significantly on Australia. We got through the global financial crisis better than almost any other country in the world. It's not the most egalitarian country in the world, I have to say. Certainly nowhere near as egalitarian as Sweden and the other Scandinavian nations, but much more even in its distribution of income and wealth than the United States, although it's, I think, headed down that road unless we can re-establish a reforming government to follow the one that's currently in office. The book by Piketty called Capital in the 21st Century is creating quite a wave of interest here, as it is in so many other countries, because it's warning of what happens if you reject the social democratic principles and go down that much more divisive and crisis-prone road, quite apart from the question of whether or not we've got any future at all without embracing policies to deal with climate change. So I mean, it's popular in politics to say we're at a crossroads, but I feel in Australia we are right now at a significant crossroads comparable to that in the 1970s, when that Whitlam government was really showing what could be done if you grasped the nettle and tried to implement progressive social reforms.
Well, just in closing, Frank Stilwell, it seems to me that that what maintains Australia's social democracy and is a model for what might happen here or could or should happen here. Well, I think the main strength to protect Australia's social democracy has been compulsory voting, because with compulsory voting, it means that even people like Abbott, who just you refer to all the lies that he made, he's reneged on every promise he made, but he had to make those promises because 90%+ of the people vote. Here in this country, less than 50% vote, and most of those people are the ones that could do most, would benefit most from a government that they're engaged in. You know, our government is essentially run by the military-industrial complex and agribusiness and the rich and powerful. But in Australia, with 95% of the people voting, every politician, including conservative ones, at least have to acknowledge social democracy and social programs.
Yes, it's certainly true that this is a very distinctive feature of the Australian scene, and it's not just that that politicians have to be accountable, therefore, to the broad mass of the people, but that it signals that democracy is about responsibilities and rights and obligations. You know, that if you want to have government for the people, by the people, then you've got to have everyone involved in that democratic process, even whether they like it or not. And I think the evidence is that most people do like it. They respect the emphasis on rights and responsibilities, which is embodied in that compulsory voting system. And you do get better outcomes, I think, than is the case in countries like the United States, where, frankly, so many people are disengaged from mainstream politics.
Well, Frank Stilwell, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for inviting me here.
Again, I've been speaking with Frank Stilwell, who's a professor emeritus in the Department of Political Economy at the University of Sydney, who is a well-known critic of conventional economics and an advocate of alternative economic strategies which prioritize social justice and economic sustainability. He joined us from Sydney, Australia. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about the conviction of the Blackwater security guards who shot 30 unarmed Iraqi civilians in 2007.
Time and time and time we see these acts against humanity. While each for each and each world leader shed blood for what they each believe. On and on and on we go. Well, some will you see and some won't be. Truth for you and truth will lead you to a sense of heart. Well, now.
Come, you masters of war. Here that build the big guns. Here that build the death planes. Here that build all the bombs. Here that hide behind walls. Here that hide behind discs. I just don't want.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Young-Pelton, who's an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He is the publisher of Dangerous Magazine and has had first-hand perspectives on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. His books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Young-Pelton.
Hi, Ian.
And on Wednesday in Washington, D.C., the jury in a federal trial found one Blackwater guard, Nicholas Slatton, guilty of first-degree murder, and three other guards were found guilty of voluntary manslaughter, Paul Slough, Evan Liberty, and Dustin Hurd, and a fifth Blackwater guard, Jeremy Ridgway, had already pleaded guilty to lesser charges and has been cooperating with the prosecutors in this case, working against his former colleagues. And of course, the trial was about the massacre of Iraqi civilians in Baghdad in 2007. Just in terms of disclosure, you know Eric Prince, the founder and head of Blackwater, and I believe that, is he suing you or are you suing him over a biography?
No, I'm suing him because he came to me with his autobiography and it was unpublishable at the time. And I agreed to work on it as long as it was truthful and contained facts and it wasn't sort of a political polemic. And he agreed to that, and then I got him a book deal with Adrian Zakheim at Penguin, which he took. And unfortunately, he meant to publish the book himself, which would have been a violation of the CIA Review Board. So he had to pretend like there wasn't another manuscript out there, because it clearly says in the CIA Review Board that if there's another version without the redactions, he could forfeit all his money. So I think that's what it's all about. But I just want to get paid for helping to write that book.
And he is now, Eric Prince, is now heading up Frontier Services Group, which has been, is he in partnership with the Chinese government? I don't know whether they're intelligence.
Yeah, he works directly for the Chinese government, and he's setting up logistical supply lines. He has like a little mini airline of about 26 aircraft in Eastern Africa. But I think he's positioning himself for the change in the government when the Republicans come back, because he's setting up exactly what AFRICOM needs over there, which is a way to transport troops and materials and supplies. He's working for the Chinese in terms of their investments over there and trying to protect them and security logistics. But ultimately, I think the long play is to create the same thing you had under Blackwater.
So Blackwater, of course, is under a new name. But so just to go back to the verdict in this trial, which has gone on forever, it does feel like the government dropped the ball rather badly and didn't handle this prosecution very well. The first jury threw it out, and then they had to go and refile the charges. They missed filing dates on one of these Blackwater mercenaries, which I think prevented them from, I think they had to charge him then again with first-degree murder instead of manslaughter. So let's deal with the trial itself. Did the government bungle this trial?
I think they could have pursued it a lot better. I think it was politically motivated from the very beginning, because what people don't realize is that the U.S. State Department and the CIA in Iraq relied almost exclusively on Blackwater security to get around. And as soon as the Iraqi government reacted to the shootings in Nisr Square and essentially shut Blackwater down, they actually shut down the U.S. government's movements in Iraq. So originally they were defended by Condi Rice, and then they were ultimately thrown under the bus. And that precipitated a number of other investigations and attempts to basically get rid of Blackwater and Eric Prince. But the company that exists now, which is actually owned by a larger British, I think it's called Constellis, these are the same people doing the same thing. They just have a different name.
So if they were working for the State Department, does the State Department have blood on its hands? I mean, is Blackwater being scapegoated here? Not that I have any sympathy for them. I mean,
no, exactly. And once again, I think people forget that Blackwater didn't get up in the morning and invade Iraq and send mercenaries over and fight wars. They were contracted by the U.S. government to protect their State Department and CIA people. And the rules and regulations were created by the U.S. government, specifically the DSS, the Department of Security, so that when they moved employees. In this case, they were taking a guy to a meeting just outside the green zone. If something happened, like a bomb went off, they had certain procedures that Blackwater had to follow. Now, that morning, and I know quite a bit about this incident because I spent a month with essentially the same group of people, you know, the Rapid Reaction Force in Baghdad. They are briefed in the morning about potential threats, and that morning they were briefed, as they always are, about white Toyotas or Mitsubishis with suicide bombers in them. So having one car bomb go off, when they were asked to block the intersection so that the convoy carrying the State Department employee could get back to the green zone, some poor fellow was in a white Mitsubishi and didn't quite understand what the hand signals, you know, they tell you to stay back, stay back. And one of the Blackwater guards fired on him, killing him, when he held up his cell phone and they thought it was a detonator. The Iraqi police would then began firing on the Blackwater convoy because they knew that this was an egregious error on the shooter's part. But the Blackwater guards were doing exactly what they were paid to do, which was block the intersection, negate any threats, and allow the State Department employee to get back to work.
So given then that the U.S. government is prosecuting Blackwater for defending the U.S. government and following their orders, and so what's going on here in terms of culpability in this trial? Has Blackwater's defense been that we were working for the U.S. government?
you know, it is very unusual for a U.S. citizen to be tried in America for a crime they committed while in a war zone overseas. And through, you know, the loopholes of jurisdiction, they were able to say, well, these guys were civilians, they were contractors, even though they were all ex-Marines and, you know, trained by the military. They were able to brand these people in the public mind as loose cannons, you know, mercenaries or whatever. But all these young men were part of the U.S. Marine Corps or some police force or military force. So in terms of, you know, should they have done this, the goal, particularly under Hillary Clinton, who hated Blackwater and Eric Prince, was to destroy Blackwater because it had political allegiances, it had a real threat to the political structure of the Democratic Party. So I think you can get kind of a little bit of conspiracy thinking in here, and you can get the fact that the laws allowed the U.S. government to prosecute these people as an example to other contractors.
Which then makes it pretty clear that there'll be a lot of activity on appeal because it is so unusual, Ryan.
Yeah, but Ian, think about this. In Benghazi, two of the men that were killed were contractors. You know, the people defending the CIA annex. Most people don't realize how pervasive armed security guards or contractors are in the defense of our military facilities, our CIA activities, NSA, et cetera, et cetera. So what we've done is we've turned these people into individuals and we've demonized them, but we haven't sat back and said, wait a second, they were working for the State Department, which has a vetting process, which has a training process, which has a review process. Why wasn't that called into question?
So let's talk about the politics of Eric Prince. You mentioned that he's likely to make a comeback if the Republicans win the Senate, and I imagine if they win the White House in 2016, if not, it'll be Hillary Clinton, who's not exactly friendly towards him, as you've just pointed out. Eric Prince is he's a right-wing Christian fundamentalist. Is that a fair description of him?
No, I don't think that's fair. You know, he's a Roman Catholic, and his family is better represented as being, you know, very conservative, very involved in religious causes, you know. But Eric has reappeared. You know, he's in Washington at a Bush-related function talking about, you know, security, and he's been on multiple news channels, including Bill O'Reilly, saying, you know, we need to send mercenaries to fight ISIS over in Iraq and Syria. So he has a very big desire to be part of some kind of political or, you know, government thinking. Obviously, that's not going to be available to him under a Democratic government.
Well, isn't that also the gravy train that's made him rich?
Well, here's the humorous part about Eric Prince. You know, he's a staunch libertarian. And as you know, libertarians believe that you should go your own way and, you know, not need government subsidies. Is a man who's made his money either by inheriting from his father or working for the government. So there's a bit of irony in his history. And yes, he has publicly said many times that he didn't think working for the State Department was worth it, and he tried to blackmail or gray mail, I think is the correct term, by doing articles in Vanity Fair and saying, you know, I was a hired assassin and I ran an assassination team. But Eric dances on the edges of legalities. And, you know, whether it's an army in Somalia to fight piracy, or whether it's an army of Colombians to protect the UAE, or whether it's his numerous snatch-and-grab antics, you know, keeping people employed in the Middle East, helping the CIA, he likes that OSS model. So he'd prefer to pretend like he's a nice, upstanding businessman and then make a lot of money in the shadows.
But it appears that he doesn't care who he makes his money from, whether it's the U.S. government or the Chinese government, who are not exactly on friendly terms, at least in terms of military and intelligence matters.
Yeah, and keep in mind, one of the things that's fascinating about Eric is that on one hand, he can talk about human rights and going to Africa to stop ethnic cleansing, and you remember his efforts on behalf of Mia Farrow and Darfur and all these things, and yet he works for the Chinese government in Africa. So you have to kind of stand back and say that this man may say one thing, but you have to look at what he actually does. And in this particular case, this group of people was working for Eric Prince because he hired them on behalf of the State Department. But ultimately, he's got enough lawyers to show you that they were actually working for the U.S. government. So the headline should read, the U.S. government convicts security guards, you know, for following their orders.
So your feeling then is that this is a partisan political prosecution, that this is Hillary Clinton's revenge against an organization that she hates, even though they work for the same State Department that she headed up.
Right, and keep in mind, Hillary Clinton was very, very vocal in 2008 about her opinion of Blackwater and private security companies because she was fairly naive at that point. She then sent around a secret memo, which I leaked in my Somali reports, encouraging a demarche on other people to encourage the use of these same mercenaries on ships because it actually stopped piracy. And then, of course, now that she's guarded 24/7, she understands the value of these people. But Eric was under investigation by at least 7 different federal agencies, you know, during the Obama/Clinton era. This is just one of the legacies of that purge, or that, I guess, inquisition, for lack of a better word.
But that's not to say that this guy is pure as a driven snow. I mean, it sounds like there is a lot to investigate.
No, I'm not defending anyone. I'm just saying that Eric has dodged many, many bullets, whether it's writing a $40 million check to avoid being prosecuted for, offering to train South Sudan's military units, or whether it's smuggling weapons or handing weapons to the King of Jordan. He's dodged many, many, many bullets. And I'm just saying that these poor guys who are at the low end of the totem pole get to spend the rest of their lives in prison because of that kind of, I don't know what the polite word is to say, but because of that sort of behavior that doesn't really take laws and logic into consequence.
But that's not to say that these fellows who've been convicted in the Washington court on Wednesday, are not going to appeal. And it sounds like
keep in mind that in a combat situation, from what I understand, the fellow on the Top Gun, probably the most violent weapon they had, was firing away wildly, thinking that they were under attack. And they were being shot at. You know, you can see the bullet marks in the side of the armored vehicle. There were also men on that unit saying, cease fire, cease fire, cease fire. So it wasn't, you know, black and white. It wasn't like all these guys went out to kill people. It was a typical combat situation in which some people are confused, some people are trying to figure out what to do, and other people are busy killing people.
And the people that were shooting at them were the Iraqi police, who presumably are well-marked their cars and their uniforms. So,
well, they're in a control tower, and the point is that they didn't know where the firing was coming from at first. They just knew they were getting rounds coming in, and one of those rounds disabled their vehicle. And when you drive these vehicles, the hydraulics stop, so you can't operate the vehicle. So the procedure is you have to get out, and you have to set up a defensive perimeter. You drop to a knee, literally, and then the Top Gun is the guy that can see everything. Now, you're in a traffic circle in Iraq. You can imagine the chaos of all these cars careening into a circle and suddenly going, oh, damn, there's a guy with a gun pointed at me. And shooting going on and people putting their hands up or trying to flee or back up. So it would be a very chaotic situation, which I've experienced many times. And I have to say, in the defense of these men, they have no history of being, you know, murderers or violent other than what we trained them to do in the Marine Corps.
Well, as it happened in this trial, a lot of Iraqis who were there and who suffered either themselves wounds or saw their next of kin killed, and a lot of them were police officers. One of the police officers, Officer Salman, talks about all these bullets raining down on him, and quoting him, this is in his trial here in the United States, I saw parts of the woman's head flying in front of me. And then there was another father of a young boy, I think he was 9 years old, who was killed, who just broke down on the stand and wept uncontrollably. They had to take the jury out. So I imagine the testimony from the Iraqi people was pretty powerful. And there is a political consequence here, isn't it? The reason that Obama, who's getting blamed for getting out of Iraq, the reason, my understanding, one of the main reasons that Obama wasn't able to make the agreement for the U.S. to stay longer in Iraq and to train the Iraqi army and to stop them being so pathetic against the Islamic State was that the Iraqis insisted on prosecuting Americans and they wouldn't give immunity. And the reason was that they were so burned by this Blackwater incident.
Well, not only that, Ian, but you got to remember that inside, I mean, I was inside Iraq from 2003 onwards, and when you drove through the streets of Baghdad and you were in a taxi or an unmarked car, you would see these convoys bearing down on you, these black Tahoes with, you know, guns sticking out the window, and they would literally just drive you off the road. And people lived in terror of these things because, you know, you're supposed to stay 100 meters back or whatever, 50, and they would fire bullets at you. I ran Route Irish every day for a month, you know, with insurgents shooting at us, but the Blackwater guys I was with were shooting at the people to get them out of the way. So, yeah, I mean, we have a terrible reputation because of the overwhelming use of these armed contractors who were just keeping the person inside the vehicle, and sometimes it was just a truck, you know, safe from potential threats. And this is the problem with Nisr Square, is that all the people that were murdered were civilians. They did not have guns. They were not firing back. They didn't have any hostile intent against that group, but they were so amped up because that bomb had just gone off and they had been told that there was another one about to go off, that they were assuming that these people were threats. And once again, insurgents don't wear uniforms, and many times they use tricks, you know, to get closer to the vehicle. So I'm not excusing what they did. I'm just saying it's a very confused environment.
But just in closing, it was the sovereign government of Iraq's decision to not allow the Americans to stay longer, and was that decision influenced by these incidents that you're describing with mercenaries, American and other?
Yeah, the popular government, the Shia government at the time, was just done with the way that we did business over there. Now, things have changed dramatically now because they want us to come back, but you know, at that time, 2007, Blackwater was a very poorly run company. They had people coming in and out. All the people that I knew were complaining about Blackwater. You know, they worked for Blackwater. They kept hiring younger and younger and less experienced people. And, yeah, it was going to happen.
Well, Robert Young-Pelton, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Young-Pelton, who's an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He's the publisher of Dangerous Magazine and has had first-hand perspectives on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. His books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.